WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The largest and most complicated ancient Egyptian tomb in the Valley of the Kings was discovered by my guest, archaeologist Kent Weeks. Buried in this tomb are the sons of the pharaoh Ramses II, who ruled from 1279 to 1213 BC. Many experts believe this was the pharaoh referred to in the Book of Exodus, the story of how Moses led the Jews out of Egypt. The tomb is known as KV5. The KV is for the Valley of the Kings, the 40-acre area that was the burial ground for the kings of ancient Egypt. KV5 has over 100 chambers and hallways and is perhaps the best-known archaeological site since the discovery of King Tut's tomb. Kent Weeks has written a new book about excavating KV5. It's called The Lost Tomb. I asked him why this tomb is so large.
With very, very few exceptions, most tombs in the Valley of the Kings were intended for the burial of one person. KV5, on the other hand, seems to have been intended for the burial of many of the sons of Ramses II. We have four mummified remains in the tomb at the moment that probably represent four of those sons. We have four names on objects that we found on the floor. But we actually have more than 25 representations of sons on the tomb walls. And that could mean that there are as many as 25 sons of Ramses II buried here. The question as to why? Well, I think that what may have happened is that because he lived for such a very long time, Ramses II decided to have himself declared a deity, not at the time of his death, but in the 30th year of his reign. He ruled Egypt for 67 years, so halfway through his career on the throne, he declared himself to be a god. Now, this immediately meant that there were certain things he could not do. As a god, he couldn't go out and cut the ribbons at irrigation canal openings or adjudicate in court matters or the other things that most pharaohs were expected to do. And I think what he therefore did was to appoint his eldest son as a sort of secular pharaoh, an assistant king. But since Ramses II outlived many of his sons, several of those young men occupied that position of authority. And as they died, predeceasing their father, they had to be given a burial that was more spectacular than that intended for an ordinary garden variety prince, but at the same time something a little farther down the line than what would be given to a full-fledged pharaoh.
We should say here that Ramses lived to the age of 90, which is pretty extraordinary for the time.
The average life expectancy in ancient Egypt was probably no greater for men than about 30 or 35. So, yes, it was astounding.
What are some of the most exciting artifacts you've found so far in K5?
The single biggest and most exciting thing, of course, is the tomb itself because of its unusual size and its unusual plan. But we are finding literally hundreds of thousands of fragmentary pieces in the tomb. This is not a tomb like King Tut's tomb, don't misunderstand me. We're not pulling out gold and jewels beyond the dreams of avarice. The tomb we know was robbed 3,000 years ago, and in fact we have a papyrus that gives us the name of one of the thieves who got caught red-handed and was put on trial. We have a transcript of the trial where he confesses to his deeds. The tomb, extensively robbed in antiquity, left untouched for 3,000 years by human hands, was nonetheless seriously damaged by a series of floods. Torrential rains fall in the Valley of the Kings about once every 100 years or so, and they wash hundreds of tons of debris down into the low-lying parts of the Valley of the Kings, and that, of course, is exactly where the tomb entrances lie. So our tomb was first plundered and then filled chock-a-block full with limestone chips and silts and sand that conspired to do some serious damage to the objects in the tomb, the ones the thieves didn't take, and to the decoration on the wall. What we're finding, though, are hundreds of thousands of pieces of pottery, lots and lots of pieces of jewelry, numerous fragments of alabaster canopic jars, the vessels in which mummified human remains were kept, fragmentary pieces of sarcophagi, of red granite, of serpentine, of alabaster, of basalt, and scores of other materials, too, statuettes, pieces of wooden, apparently coffin fragments, and thousands upon thousands of very delicate pieces of decorated plaster that have fallen from the wall. It's a terrifically difficult job trying to excavate this material because the debris that filled the tomb after these flash floods has dried to the consistency of concrete, and yet the fragmentary objects that we're finding in this matrix are extremely fragile and have to be excavated with dental picks and toothbrushes. It's an archaeological nightmare.
What was the importance of a pharaoh's passing? Why did the pharaoh seem to require this huge tomb with statues representative of the gods of the afterlife and so on in the tomb with him, and sacrificial animals and wall paintings and all of this? What was the significance of all of that? Is it just like the pharaoh's big ego that he wants all of this to accompany him in his grave, or was there something more than that?
No, I don't think it was egomania that was governing the way in which these royal tombs were carved. There was a very significant need here and a very significant concern. First of all, this is rather simplified, but I think it's relatively close to being on the mark. The communications that took place between man and gods existed only through the pharaoh. He was rather like the constriction in an hourglass, with the gods in the upper half, humankind in the lower half. If the pharaoh died or were taken ill, the line of communication between the gods and mankind was gone. And in consequence, the gods could not make known their wishes to us, nor could we make known our desires to them. It was extremely important that this line of communication be left open. And that's one of the reasons that not only was there an almost immediate succession to the throne of the next in line, but a very, very concerted effort to make sure that the soul of the deceased king could travel into the afterlife, take his rightful place with the gods, and work on behalf of you and me in the afterlife to ensure that next year's grain harvests would be good, that the sun would continue to rise and set every day, that the Nile would flood every spring and summer, and so on.
How did you discover the tomb known as K5?
Well, I wish I could say that it was because we were really smart and did some good detective work and so on, but in actual fact, it was fairly straightforward. We knew there was going to be a tomb lying near the entrance of the Valley of the Kings, and we knew that because the tomb entrance had been shown as a little black dot, nothing more, but had been shown on several 19th century explorers' maps, most of them unpublished, but accessible in the British Museum.
How did you know you had discovered the tomb? What was the first sign?
The first sign was after we had dug through that debris, we found a smoothness on the stone that indicated that this was the result of human work, not natural erosion. And that turned out to be the top of a doorway. We exposed that doorway. We could not crawl into the tomb immediately because, as I say, the tomb is filled with debris all the way to the ceiling. But there was a small tunnel dug through the debris in 1825 by an English traveler named James Burton, and he went about 40 feet into the tomb. He couldn't see anything from his tunnel. He could see the ceiling, which was undecorated over his head, but to his left and his right and below his knees, there was nothing, just limestone chips and debris. So he, too, lost interest in the tomb and went away. We wanted, however, to get some better handle on what this tomb might be, so we spent part of each of the next six seasons slowly carrying out the debris from the first small chamber of the tomb, noting the stratigraphy, the layers of the soil as we went, in hopes that we could reconstruct the history of flooding. And what we found in the first room was a big surprise to us. We found that the walls were, in fact, very elegantly decorated with painted reliefs and had on them hieroglyphic texts, giving us the names of sons of Ramses II. When we got down to the floor level, we began finding hundreds, indeed thousands, of fragmentary objects. Clearly, this seemed to have been a tomb that had been used. It wasn't until 1995 that we had gone far enough into the tomb that we realized that this was not a small two- or three-chambered tomb, typical of many of those in the Valley of the Kings, but rather something more special. And it was in February of 1995 that we found a doorway in the back wall of one of the first chambers, and when we penetrated that doorway, we looked, shone our flashlight through the space between the debris and the ceiling, and discovered a corridor extending more than 100 feet ahead of us, with chambers and corridors going off of it in every which direction.
And that part was not packed with flood debris?
That was not as fully packed with flood debris. There was flood debris in it, but there was, instead of being an 18-inch crawl space between it and the ceiling, there was a crawl space that was almost 3 feet high.
What's the most exciting find so far in the tomb that you've been excavating?
Well, I think the fact that we have found now evidence that clearly indicates this was a tomb and it was used as the multiple burial place for sons of Ramses II. The fact that we not only have found decorated walls, sarcophagus fragments, canopic jar fragments, all of those things, of course, helped indicate that this was definitely a tomb, but there was always the possibility that it could be what's known as a fake tomb or a memorial, a cenotaph. But now, as of last spring, we have found the remains of four adult male mummies in the tomb. We're hoping to do some DNA testing of them at some point in the not-too-distant future, but I suspect that these are, in fact, the actual bodies of sons of Ramses II. They were all found jumbled together in a pit lying in the floor of the second small room just inside the entrance to the tomb. That's not where they originally came from. I suspect that tomb robbers had found them much farther inside the tomb, many hundreds of feet farther inside the tomb, and had dragged the bodies up near the front door of the tomb so they had better light while they ripped the bodies apart looking for the gold amulets and other things that they were pretty sure such mummies would contain.
Now, you say in your book about K5 that even if you were able to finish excavating the tomb in your lifetime, you wouldn't. You'd leave some unexcavated for future generations of archaeologists. Why?
The reason for leaving a good part of the tomb unexcavated now is, it's a fairly simple reason, but one that has only recently come to the attention of archaeologists. We know that every generation of Egyptologists, of archaeologists, come equipped to their project with new techniques. We have techniques today for excavation, for interpretation, that were not available to our predecessors, even a generation or two ago. And it's, I think, a foregone conclusion that succeeding generations of Egyptologists, 50, 75, 100 years from now, will have new techniques of interpretation and of analysis that we haven't even dreamed of. The other thing is that every generation of historians, of archaeologists, asks new questions about the material. Just as one example, 30 years ago, nobody had ever asked the question, what was the role of women in ancient Egyptian society? Today, there are about 30 books and hundreds of articles on that very topic. Now, every generation has such questions that are almost specific to it, that help define the field in a given generation. If we were to completely dig out KV5 now, it would mean that we could neither ask new questions of its data, nor could we bring to bear new analytical techniques for its analysis. And I think that would be wrong, particularly since KV5 does seem to be a unique tomb. And since it's unlike anything else ever found in Egypt, it may very well be the only one of its kind that exists. I would hope that we will dig enough of KV5 to get a good, thorough picture of its extent and of its function. But I also would hope that we can leave a very substantial amount of it, probably more than half of it, undug and left for future generations to work on.
It's interesting that as you're excavating the past, you're also thinking about the future.
Well, I think one has to. Not digging everything is as much a part of the conservation and protection of archaeological treasures as is the work of the chemist or the botanist to preserve things for posterity.
Kent Weeks' new book, The Lost Tomb, is about excavating the tomb in which the sons of the pharaoh Ramses II are buried. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Kent Weeks, the archaeologist who discovered the tomb of the sons of the pharaoh Ramses II. You were working in the tomb during the terrorist attack in Egypt in November of 1987, and this is the attack that killed 58 Egyptians and tourists. How close was the terrorist attack to the tomb?
It was very close. We were separated from Deir al-Bahri, the temple where the attack took place, by a narrow ridge that is about 500 or 600 feet wide. We were in the Valley of the Kings. The attack took place on the other side of that hill. We could hear everything, the screams and the gunshots, but fortunately we could not see anything. Several of our workmen, however, recognized the gunshots and immediately knew what they were, and they raced over and gave chase to a couple of the terrorists. A couple of them had members of their family killed in the process. One of our workmen's brother was shot as he was giving chase to one of the terrorists. It was an extremely unpleasant experience, but the most amazing thing was we were in the valley, as I say. There were tourists coming in and out. The police didn't arrive for about 2 hours. People oblivious to what was going on, but our workmen told us, "Don't worry, you stay in the tomb, go ahead and do your work." My wife went down and recording pottery, and I was helping our photographer set up some lights, I think. And we continued to work, and our workmen stood outside and formed a defensive perimeter around the tomb entrance, saying that if anybody comes over and tries to do anything, they will go after them, they will kill them. I've never felt so safe in my life, I must admit. These guys were really absolutely willing to put their life on the line.
They were unarmed, though. I mean, how much could
unarmed they have except for hoes and sticks and stones, and several of the terrorists who did get caught by local villagers actually had been kicked and stoned to death before the police showed up.
The tourists returned?
They are beginning to return. The day before the incident, I think that the hotel occupancy rate in Luxor was hovering at about 97%. 2 days later, after the incident had occurred, it had dropped to about 2%. And I think now it's probably back up to the 30 or 40% level. I hope that it will pick up over the next several months. The problem is not, you know, the big tour operators, they can weather these storms. They can survive. But it's the people who depend upon selling postcards at the entrance of the Valley of the Kings to make even a few cents a day in order to help feed their families. These are the ones who really suffer. They've got no backup position, no fallback position at all.
Kent Weeks is my guest, and he's the archaeologist who discovered K5, which is the largest tomb discovered yet in the Valley of the Kings in Egypt. And he's written a new book about it called The Lost Tomb. I would love to get a sense from you what it feels like to be, you know, below the ground in an ancient Egyptian tomb of the pharaoh's sons.
It's one of the most amazing experiences that I think I have ever had. Fortunately, I am not claustrophobic. I had one attack of claustrophobia inside the tomb once when I was crawling over the debris and then had to go down into a small hole to go through a doorway, and I got stuck in the door, bent literally like a paperclip in a U-shape, and could move neither forward nor backward. Fortunately, one of our workmen was there and grabbed me by the ankles and pulled me out. But that's the only time I have ever had that kind of a panic attack. The tomb itself is uncomfortable as all get out. First of all, you're crawling over limestone chips that are extremely sharp. When limestone fractures, it makes razor-sharp edges. And you're tearing your clothes and often cutting your hands or your knees or your feet. The tomb is hot. Going into the tomb chambers, it will be in the 90s, sometimes even close to 100 inside the tomb, and it is humid. Extremely uncomfortable. Your glasses will fog up, and if you go in to do some photography, we have to take the cameras in and leave them for about 2 hours before the temperatures stabilize and the lenses unfog. It's dark. I have never experienced such total darkness as one can find in this tomb, or such total silence. It's really quite eerie. Going into the tomb on a couple of occasions, our flashlights, because of the humidity and the heat, the flashlight batteries don't last very long, and we have gotten down into some deep recess several hundred feet from the entrance, and suddenly the flashlight batteries have failed. It's really an amazing experience, rather scary.
I would imagine there are times that you thought about what it would be like if you were accidentally buried alive in the tomb.
Yeah, on a couple of occasions, the thought crossed our minds. When we went for the first time into one of the interior portions of the tomb, we had to weave our way in and amongst some columns and some 2- and 3-ton blocks of stone that had fallen from the ceiling. And again, it was totally dark. We had 2 flashlights between the 3 of us, which was silly, but that's all we had. And we got in there, and I suddenly turned to our workman, Mohammed, and I said, "Do you remember where the entrance is?" He said, "No," and neither did the graduate student who was with me. And here we were in a pitch-black environment, and we weren't quite sure which way was out. It took us about 10 minutes to find the doorway, and it was not a very pleasant time, I can assure you.
I know there's a lot of dust in the tomb. What is tomb dust like?
It's like breathing in fine silts. If you were to take a sieve and take dirt from your garden or perhaps something like moss and so forth from the garden and sift it, it would be that sort of fine material. And it covers everything. It when you're in the tomb, of course, you're sweating, so it begins to adhere to your clothes and you come out looking like you're covered with a chocolate mass. It sticks to your hands and your face and gets in your lungs, and so you spend a good deal of your time hacking and coughing. And on a couple of occasions, some of us have come down with minor respiratory problems from breathing in too much of it. We usually wear face masks when we are in the tomb because of that. But by and large, the place is just unpleasant, except for one thing. It is archaeologically one of the most exciting places I can imagine being, and I'm more than willing to put up with the discomfort because of the excitement of finding something more in this tomb that will tell us about, well, what arguably is one of the greatest periods in Egyptian history.
Well, Kent Weeks, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, it's been my pleasure. Thank you.
Kent Weeks' new book, The Lost Tomb, is about excavating the tomb of the sons of the pharaoh, Ramses II. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.